start off with, say whatever you want, and then we'll go with these questions for a short time.
Well, I think kind of a general introduction that Bentley visited me when I was still in California.
Well, let me get your name. The number one question.
All right.
Name, department, rank, or position at the time.
Alfred Knudsen, and I was associate dean for basic sciences, I think.
I see.
When I first came there, we had kind of anomalous appointments. Ed Pellegrino and I, as you know, were the first two people there.
Right.
We arrived September 1st, 1966.
66. All right.
And we had never met each other before.
Yeah.
Bentley recruited both of us.
I see. How old were you at the time?
44.
All right. And from what institution and position did you come?
I came from City of Hope Medical Center.
Where?
City of Hope.
City of Hope.
Medical Center.
Medical Center.
Duarte, California.
I see.
And I was chairman of the Department of Biology there.
There.
And I had previously been chairman of the Department of Pediatrics there.
I see. Where is Duarte?
It's in L.A. County, not far from Pasadena.
Oh, yes. I see.
It's spelled D-U-A-R-T-E.
Yes, I would guess. Right. Question four. You were about to answer that one. Who was primarily responsible for your coming to Stony Brook?
Well, it was Bentley Glass. We had a conversation, I think it was perhaps during the Christmas holiday of 1965, it would have been. And he was visiting some friends at Caltech, notably Ray Owen, I believe. And he was telling about, so I heard, this experiment that they wanted to try at Stony Brook. Some new ideas about medical education in a different kind of setting. And
did he mention the Muir Commission?
No, I don't remember. He could have, but I don't remember anything.
Okay.
I shouldn't say that. He could easily have, and I just didn't know enough about it to recognize.
Right. It was the commission appointed jointly by the governor and the regents on education for the health sciences that had visited Stony Brook in 62, and Malcolm Muir and Lester Evans of the Commonwealth Fund. And they had the idea that the two institutions, that is, a health sciences center and the university, should grow together. So they were looking for, not for an existing institution, really, but for one that was developing.
Right.
And the next year, when the report came out, the first health science center to be built in the state was to be located at Stony Brook.
Hmm.
And that started a good deal of...
Well, now, they already had something in Brooklyn and...
That's right.
Albany and Syracuse.
That's right. That's right. But
this one was to be built fresh up.
Fresh and more comprehensive.
Yeah. Right. And that was an attractive theme because although there were other medical schools that were on general university campuses, they hadn't been built at this particular kind of crucial time. Although there were some in the building, but many of them... This is a little off, but I think it provides a context because it was one of the things we did when we got there was to look at the other places that were building, notably Michigan State, San Diego, UC San Diego, UC Davis, and the California ones, for example. There were three built, Davis, San Diego, and Irvine, around the same time. And they all ran into big problems because they ran short of funds because they had gotten too ambitious. And they all had to settle for county hospitals, which were removed from the campus. And in interfered greatly with progress in all three places, and even to this day represent problems for those institutions.
I see.
So this looked like a really interesting possibility, and of course Bentley had his own personal view about new things in medical education, and he and I kind of hit it off.
Good.
And then over the next few months we talked some more, and he identified Ed as another person he would like to bring. Ed was already an experienced person in administration and health sciences, whereas I had always stuck closer to the clinical and research side. And
I've never been to Hunterdon,
but I gather that was a sizable...
Yes, and that
was a widely cited experiment by a medical school in the distribution of medical care. And since that idea was also embraced by Bentley's notions, and I had some thoughts that I guess meshed well with Bentley's about science in relation to medical education, where things are going. When I left there 3 years later, I'll get you a copy of this letter, which was my resignation letter. And but apropos of the present discussion, I said, I believe very firmly that the plans for Stony Brook's Health Sciences Center constitute a unique contribution toward the resolution of one of the great crises in American and, in fact, world medicine, a crisis born of an unprecedented conjunction of available technology and unfulfilled need for service, that this combination was coming together at that time. And as you know, we still haven't really solved that problem. In fact, just this week, the editorial in the New England Journal says something to the fact that, that it's now time for universal health insurance. Well, I think we thought it was already late then. So you see, a lot of the things we were addressing at that time still aren't really solved. It
takes a long time.
Because no one institution can solve that big plan.
Why did you go to Stony Brook?
Well, it sounds a little crazy, but I got caught up in thinking about these problems, and also the promise of Stony Brook. In fact, when you called me, I got out the file, and one of the items in the file was the article in, I think it was Time magazine, about Stony Brook.
Oh.
And how it was touted as the Berkeley of the East. This was around 65 or 66, before I arrived, but not much before. And the arrival of Toll and Yang and Bentley all made it sound like there was going to be a big push. And
I think, well, there was.
There was a lot of excitement. We even had people writing to us inquiring about jobs, and some of them were quite well-known people, just out of the blue. So I think there was some excitement generated by the possibilities there.
Right.
So I guess that
it was an opportunity for the state of New York.
Very coming late to public higher education.
Yes, and
factor that you mentioned, that the college itself wasn't really that old, and it was in a formative state too, but already indicating that it could attract some good people. So I think if one asks almost anybody that was recruited at that time, not just at the Health Sciences Center, but in the other areas too, that they would cite this excitement.
I get that as an answer to this question from virtually everybody.
I'm not surprised.
Yes.
We were all a little soft in the head, you know.
Well, I think if you can't be excited about something, life isn't worth living anyway. So I think it was
the main motivation for many of us.
Yes.
Right. Because many of us sort of interrupted our normal careers to go there.
Well, let's see. Do you want? I would be very happy to have a copy of the letter.
Sure.
The letter.
I'd be glad to. When Ed and I got there, he's probably already told you this, but it's a little more compact in my memory because he stayed on for a while afterwards. I was just there 3 years. We moved rather quickly toward getting plans going for the place. I can't remember just when, but in the first year, Bud Goldberg was already signed up as the architect for the place.
And how did you get him?
We didn't get him. The state made that arrangement somehow. I don't know how that was done.
I see.
I suspect it was done through Albany. But John Toll and Bentley would probably know the answer to that.
I'm not sure that we...
But we were not involved in selecting him as the architect.
Right.
He was a given for us. But we didn't object. We went out to visit him in Chicago and had a lot of interaction with him, of course. And I thought he was pretty interesting.
And he had experience with hospitals?
He built
a couple of...
Not much, I think. He was most famous for Marina City.
Yeah,
Chicago.
Right.
But he was accumulating some people, and there was also a big input from, what was the... There was a...
Owen Stevens?
No, there was a... Medical Center Planning Group housed in Tiburon, California. His name escapes me at the moment.
He was out, you mean out here, out in California?
Yeah.
I see.
And they had also been hired before our coming on the scene.
I see.
And we had a lot of interactions with them, and it was they who, I think they even went with us on some of these visits to other medical schools that were in the building. At that time,
they were architects or engineers?
Well, I think basically it was a planning group that contracted a lot of services to architects and engineers and had a lot of input from, you see, there were a number of medical schools either having just been built or being built at that time. And so they were the right people at the right place at the right time.
I see.
I think they were in on the planning of a lot of the new medical schools.
And what was their name again?
Well, I can't remember. It might occur to me as we progress.
Right.
So it was Ed and myself interacting, of course, with the whole complex at Stony Brook, together with this planning group, together with Goldberg, the architect.
I said
we're really planning the center.
I remember the long shelf of volumes
that
you came up with. We still have that, of course, in the library. You must have done a lot of work
in these plans. Yes. The state even insisted that we drop equipment lists for all the labs when nobody had been hired.
That's really crazy. Well, they had the... They were accustomed with us to include with the appropriation for the building, an appropriation for its equipment. And they were getting ahead of themselves.
Well, it presented a big problem for us because there were two aspects to it. One was the specifics of the equipment. But there was also the general question of what kind of a health science center was this going to be.
Yes.
They had in mind a medical school that would start out with somewhere around, I can't remember, 100 or so students, but get up to about 200 students, as I recall. And that was really the determinant of the size of the medical school in some ways. But then Ed and I had the additional problem of deciding what kind of a medical school it would be, because the number of students doesn't decide the size of the whole place. Because you see, a lot of things are variable. If you look through the documents of various medical schools that we did, you find that the number of postdoc fellows or PhDs or post-MD clinical fellows or graduate students, PhD graduate students, those are very variable from medical school to medical school per 100 students. Yeah. And the places like Harvard and Hopkins and Stanford that are research intensive, of course, have many more such people in those categories than the average school would have. So we were in the position of trying to decide what kind of a medical school did we want to be. Did we want the numbers of graduate students and postdocs and fellows that the average school had, or did we want to be aspiring to something better than that? Well, of course, we wanted to aspire to something more, so we had many more. That greatly enlarges the square feet per medical student, which is kind of a meaningless thing, because the Health Sciences Center medical school is almost, it might be the original reason for having, but once you decide to have it, then there are many other considerations that come in that determine the size of the faculty and the building.
Right. What was the context in New York State at that time of other medical centers?
Yes.
That you looked at?
Both in New York and in the Northeast generally, the tradition has always been that the private schools were the great schools,
right?
Harvard, Yale, Columbia, Cornell, mm-hmm. Hopkins, so on. And medicine, I'm talking about.
Right.
And even to this day, the state university schools are second class compared to those. Now, I'm not running them down. I'm just saying that they don't have the same stature in medical science that the private schools have. So if you go to places like the University of Connecticut or University of Massachusetts or most of the SUNY schools or Rutgers or University of Maryland, you may find very good medical schools, but none of them have the reputation of these others. So, even in New York at that time, Syracuse, very nice school, Albany, and Brooklyn, you can cite many individuals who were fine in those schools, even in research. But if you looked at the place as a whole, they were definitely different from Columbia, Cornell, NYU, Einstein. You know, private schools were really pretty high up there, and Mount Sinai, I think, came into existence after that, around that time, I can't remember exactly.
But Mount Sinai, I always thought of that as a hospital.
Well, it was, but it became a medical school. It's now a medical school.
I see.
So, Stony Brook was really trying to be one of these up here.
Yes. one of the best.
They were trying to operate in the class with the private schools being a public school. Mm-hmm. So there was a big challenge right there.
Right.
We had this image that the private schools of New York, mm-hmm. and that included Rochester upstate, there was Buffalo also, the public school.
Right.
We were pouring poison into the administration and the legislature of New York to say, let us, the private schools, do the high-powered research,
yeah.
just turn out doctors at the state places. Yeah. And we were doing everything we could to resist that.
Were you successful? Well,
since I don't really know the situation there, I would say I don't know, but I certainly hear a lot more about Stony Brook's medical school, not because I was there, but because I read things in the literature, and it seems to me that they have more than their share of publications in good journals from the private, the public sector of the Northeast.
Yes. I think that's true. The hospital now has 450 beds in operation.
And, but just numbers aren't enough. Buffalo has plenty of beds, and so do these other places. And there are a lot of resources in Buffalo. But I think if you just talk about good medical science, I think Stony Brook really did work its way into this larger scene. But it's been tough, and I think that they probably still have a way to go to catch up with the others, because the others are pretty strong.
Yeah.
Right. The private schools, I mean.
Yeah. Right.
But they certainly are an anomaly. They're better than some of the private schools, and I would say clearly better known in research circles than almost any of the state schools in the Northeast. But that's kind of a tradition in the Northeast, that the state schools are not. In the Midwest and in the Far West,
it's a different story.
And even in the South, yes. The tradition was always with the state schools. And the anomalies are the few private schools that are famous.
Emory, for instance, is one.
Yeah, and Stanford and Chicago and a few, Washington University and St. Louis. But you can almost count the ones, Vanderbilt, that are private and really good in the rest of the country, whereas it's just the reverse here. So Stony Brook was lucky in that.
You and Ed were the first people to come on the scene, but you two brought in some others.
Yes.
Who were the ones that you brought in?
Well, you put me on the spot. Howie Oakes was one of the first.
I see.
You're trying my memory now. We brought in a dean of the...
Upton?
No, he was later. I'm talking about right away
right
at the beginning.
I see.
We brought in a dean of Allied Health, but I can't remember his name.
McTernan?
Yeah. And then also the dean of nursing.
Yes.
His name you'll probably supply me.
They?
Yeah.
Yes. F-A-H-Y. I've forgotten what her first name was.
Ellen.
Ellen?
F-A-H-E-Y or F-A-H-Y?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. How did you go about looking?
Well, Ed was very much up on the health sciences centers.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, we had some consultants come in. We had a very strong consultant in dentistry from Alabama, I remember. And he had a lot to say about the design of teaching spaces. It was his emphasis that the wave of the future was what's referred to as four-hand dentistry, where a dentist and a technician would work together. And that many of the functions of dentists in the past were now going to be performed by other people that didn't have doctoral degrees. And these consultants would also put us on to other people. And Howie was interesting to us because he was in charge of this program at Harvard, which was a very small school. I think they had 16 students a year or something like that. And they had Doctor of Medical Dentistry degree. Now that's a rather more common thing, but I think Harvard was one of the first places to do that. So he was interesting to us because he had ideas about community dentistry and the way dentists should work to solve the problems of dental care, but at the same time be related to research. The Allied Health That was an interesting problem because there wasn't a very good model to go by in our estimation. The largest school by far was in Boston and associated with Northeastern.
Oh, really?
Yes, because each one of the medical schools didn't want to get into that.
I see.
And so Northeastern picked up all the chips and got heavy endorsement from all the other places. Mm-hmm. So it was like they got together and had a game plan, mm-hmm. which is probably one of the few cases where all the institutions in Boston really worked together for something. And Turnham was there. I can't remember what his function was. He might even have been the dean. I don't know that program.
I haven't interviewed him. Maybe I should.
But we got caught up in that. Mm-hmm. And Ed always emphasized strongly the training of all of the other people in the health sciences that were very important for the distribution of medical care in the future.
Now, by allied health sciences,
that's generally taken to
what does it mean,
the bachelor or master's degree level of the training, sort of parallel with nursing, but embracing all kinds of things, including occupational therapy, for example, physical therapy, but now much broader, including some bioengineering and I think the program in Northeastern consisted of something like 22 programs,
goodness,
in allied health sciences, and that's why it was attractive to us. We thought we really, and as I recall, we had had McTurnan down as a consultant on allied health because we thought the Northeastern program was probably the most comprehensive in the United States. They had, I think they had over 2,000 students in that program.
Goodness.
My memory is not so sure on some of these things, but I know it was a huge program.
What was your impression of Stony Brook when you got there, of the people you were dealing with on the campus, and did you have any connections with people up in Albany?
Well, the answer is yes all around.
All right.
First of all, there was all the interaction with John Toll Bentley. And because...
How did you find John Toll?
Well, I found him keenly interested in the future of this operation. And Bentley, of course, is his baby. I think Bentley was the one who really was the driving force for them. And cared deeply about it. I think John was perhaps more interested in the university as a whole.
He had to be.
And it might even be that he was worried about the Health Science Center taking over the place, as was also true for many of the other faculty. We had a lot of meetings with people in the various departments, some of which were dictated by John's interest in making sure that the standards of the university were upheld in the Health Science Center. So there would be input from distinguished faculty people in various disciplines into the appointments of people and so on.
Can you mention any of them?
Yeah. Sure. For example, Max Dresden had a keen interest in the way things were going, and even came up with some suggestions that people came to know about. Alex Pond was involved to some extent. Hoffman, of course, had an administrative role at the university.
Yes,
he was Bentley's assistant or something.
That's right,
like
for
that.
A while he was. That's right.
So Charlie was quite involved in the plans for the center. Bernie Semmel was on some committees. We had a lot of conversation with Kalish and Krasner and some of the other people in psychology, because that was
one of the closer disciplines. And then, of course, we had interactions with PERC. Our strongest reaction and interaction in biology was with Mel Simpson, because Mel was hired at the same time we were. I remember meeting him as we were both being recruited, and he was hired into the biology department with the understanding that he would be the chairman of biochemistry in the Health Sciences Center, and was supposed to be one of the magicians that would work biology and the Health Sciences Center together. we had some interaction.
That didn't quite work out.
I don't know.
I see.
During the time I was there, well, I had a lot of conversations with him.
Yeah.
He was always very helpful. There were some people in other departments.
Anybody in social sciences, anthropology,
well,
or sociology?
Herb Weisinger, as I recall, was involved in some things.
He was in English,
in the humanities.
He was dean of the graduate school later, I guess.
Peter Weil was a personal friend of mine over in Earth Sciences, and whatever
Marine Sciences
that department
yeah.
was. But he was in oceanography, basically.
Right.
And I'm a little mixed up whether he was ever officially involved in anything or whether I just had a lot of personal conversations, but he certainly was quite interested in what was happening. So I found it very stimulating, interacting with all those people. And I thought it was a good bunch. We also had some interaction with Yang. I can't remember exactly why. I guess the main thought, though, was that the best people, by best I mean the ones who are old enough to have made big reputations, wanted this to happen, but they wanted it to be really good.
Yeah. No.
And I think that was Toll's big preoccupation.
Yes.
And Bentley's too. Toll gets credit for the construction program, but he also is given credit by Sam Gould as wanting the same level of quality that Sam Gould wanted.
I think on the idea side, they were both very strong. For me, the big failure was at the operational level.
Yes.
And the big failure was somewhere. One of the big problems Ed and I had was identifying who was going to make any decisions.
Yes.
For example, I think we were there about 2 months and we submitted a proposal for a temporary building into which we could bring chairpersons of basic sciences and get a skeletal crew going. Because we knew that when you start a medical school,
yeah,
if you really are going to do a good job, you should have the hospital there as soon as you can. So we wanted to build a hospital right away. Now, when it came to basic sciences, assuming that you can't build everything immediately,
yeah,
we'd rather get started with the hospital. Because we knew that if you're recruiting some basic science chairman, and you bring in a guy and you say, look, here's a blank department. You're going to have 10 to 20 people to hire. You're going to put up with temporary buildings in those conditions because it's just too exciting a possibility to pass up. You can't get a job like that within a day. So our thought was that we would have the building get going on the hospital, but ask for some temporary buildings for these other people. And the final surge building is a result of that.
So-called surge building, which I guess is a couple of
half a dozen of them. And so we wanted to get going right away.
Right.
Well, you know, the approval came for that just about the time I was leaving, almost 3 years later,
yeah,
which I thought was preposterous. And Ed became quite frantic because he was supposed to go through John Toll, and John Toll was supposed to go through somebody in, I don't know, Sam Gould or whoever, and it just seemed to get lost somewhere. You didn't even know who was... You couldn't even get a no answer from people on many
times. Yeah. Well, that's the bureaucracy.
So my own personal reason for leaving was that things were getting... We already knew it was going to take until probably 72 from 66 to have a hospital up and running. 6 years. Well, everything was back at least 3 years. And the rate it was going, I thought it could be 10 years before things were going. And I just didn't want to sit around that long. So when a very nice opportunity came up in Texas, I went.
Where'd you go?
I went to the MD Anderson Hospital, Tumor Institute, which is run by the University of Texas. A very famous cancer place. One of the four largest in the country.
National Cancer Institute, MD Anderson, Memorial Sloan Kettering, and one in Buffalo. Those are the four biggest places.
Is the one in Buffalo related in any way to
Roswell Clark?
The university?
I think...
What was the name you gave?
Roswell Park.
Roswell
Memorial
Park. I see.
Hospital.
I see.
And the full operation. My understanding is that it's run by the education department of the state for some reason.
Oh, really?
I don't understand. No, excuse me. I don't remember. It's,
yeah.
It's run by a different agency that runs the university.
I see.
But they collaborate, and I think they're
they
talking about
to, yeah.
fusing them now
right.
in some way.
Right.
But it wasn't run by the university, but it was run by the state. But the particular agencies, I don't remember, but it was two different departments, as I recall, of the state.
State Department of Health?
Might have been the State Department of Health, yeah. And then the education would have been running the university.
Yeah.
So, I was really upset because I felt that I'd put in a lot of effort in 3 years, and while I had faith that something was going to happen, I thought there were two losses. One was my personal loss, and the other was really a loss for Stony Brook, in that although it was certainly going to be a good place because they were putting a lot into it, it had lost some of this excitement that it had created.
Yeah.
That was in that article of Time Magazine.
Yeah.
Or Newsweek, or whatever it was, that this idea that it was going to be the Berkeley of the East, instant fame and all that, really seemed like a possibility. And the way things were happening all over the campus, not just in health science, but in other departments, hiring good people all the time, I thought, you know, maybe we can just pull it off. But then I had this opportunity to go down to Texas and start a medical genetics center.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a big interest in cancer and genetics,
mm-hmm.
which I have to this day.
Mm-hmm.
I would sort of go back to the research mode,
mm-hmm.
abandon this
yeah.
education business.
Yeah. Now this place here, Fox Chase
Cancer Center.
Cancer Center.
It's one of the 20 comprehensive cancer centers in the United States.
I see.
Under the National Cancer Act that Nixon put in. And it's a place with a hospital and a research operation. Small, but good quality, I think. You had me identified as director of the institute, which I was for 6 years, but I haven't been director now for the last 5.5 years.
I see.
I've just gone back to doing research.
Research.
My official title is senior member.
Senior member.
Okay.
What's the name of your research, or what area?
Well, I'm still interested in cancer genetics. I have been involved in trying to understand what is it that's inherited when one inherits a condition of cancer.
Right.
And I had made some years ago, not long after I left Stony Brook, the ideas were already, I think, incubating there, some models about how this could happen, and made some predictions, and in the last 3 or 4 years, those predictions have been shown by other people to be correct, and so there's been a lot of interest in that.
Good. Good. And by contrast, have you studied the families in which there has been no cancer for many generations?
I have not, but I think that's a very interesting subject, and there was somebody rather recently called attention to that problem, and in fact there are families like that, where there is just way lower incidence of cancer than you would expect.
I come from two lines like that.
Mm-hmm. I think those are quite interesting.
One English, one German.
Well, I've been interested mostly in the ones where a single gene imposes a great increase in risk.
I see.
Not just a little, a great increase. To try to understand what those genes are. And it turns out that they are very important in non-hereditary cancer. In non-hereditary cancer. Just regular cancer.
I see.
Come in. Can you?
Yeah.
Hi. I didn't know you were still in here because I couldn't see any light on the bottom of the door, but keep going. I'm just
light.
Going to my next apartment.
We're providing the light.
Bye.
See you later. So, it's actually a very exciting time now because the old question was, all right, so suppose mutation does cause cancer. What are the genes that are being mutated? And there are two groups of genes that have been identified. One was identified through a study of cancer viruses, and they're called oncogenes. And the other was identified through this study of hereditary cancer, and I've called those anti-oncogenes. Some people call them tumor suppressor genes. The difference being that an oncogene causes cancer when it's doing too much, overacting, or misacting, turning on something in the wrong way, but it implies action of the gene. The anti-oncogenes, the normal gene is turning down cell division, and when you knock out both copies, there's nothing to turn down. So it's the loss of genes that's causing cancer with that group. And when one gets hereditary cancer, you've inherited in all the cells of the body one of those defects. And then as soon as some cell in the target tissue loses the other normal copy, then you get a cancer. So there's been a big improvement in understanding of what's going wrong in cancers. Very good.
You have given your impressions under 8. You want to add anything under 9? What events, what persons, what experiences stand out?
Well, I always remember, I tend to remember the good things.
Good.
I personally particularly enjoyed thinking about how we could impact on the world of medicine and medical science. And that here was an opportunity to really train young people in a system of medical care in relation to science. That any previous efforts that were, in retrospect, viewed as good had sort of grown like topsy or been devised on ad hoc basis, and it didn't impact on medical education, that we weren't educating young doctors in this system people were discovering things and learning how to improve the system and how to translate advances in medical science into practice, and beginning to be concerned about the idea that everybody should be entitled to these things. But medical education had been somewhat ossified for a long time,
falling behind experience,
and really wasn't emphasizing these points. It was still pretty much one-on-one medicine. And at that time, you remember, there was a lot of talk about socialized medicine.
Yeah.
And there was enormous opposition to organized medicine to such things. And many of us felt at the time that this was the worst thing they could do, because it was so obvious that something was going to have to be done, that the government or other agencies would take over and medicine, organized medicine, would have nothing to say about how it would happen. And to a large extent, that's what has happened. By the time organized medicine woke up, it was a little too late.